Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. The Bible's laws about slavery can be troubling, but they reveal something deeper. Even within ancient realities, God's instructions are aimed to bring dignity, protection, and a pathway to freedom for everyone. That includes Israelites and outsiders alike. In Exodus 21-22, Jeremiah 34, and similar passages, we see that Scripture moves toward greater justice, mercy, and inclusion. Ultimately, all these hopes find their fulfillment in the Messiah. He opens the door to true freedom for every person and nation. He reveals God's heart to set all captives free and welcome all into His family.
Exodus 21-22, and then also, of course, it ties a little bit into, actually a little bit of John 10, which is covered, into how we're going to address this topic. You will note that when we're covering this section of Exodus, for the most part, it covers all about the laws, about how to apply them. So we have the Ten Commandments, right, given to us the previous passage. And now we're looking at, in Moses, how he's relaying this information from God's understanding, is to explain how do we apply these different laws. In this case, it's the laws of man to man, with regards to kidnapping and slavery and servants and all kind of stuff, and property, how property works, thieving and that kind of thing. All those commandments, how they're addressed in real life applications. I find it funny. I've always thought this is funny to me, because it's me, I think it's funny, is that with a semi standard, not quite the right word, but a semi twisted or altered version of a Christian philosophies, which I'm reading to my kids right now for Hanukkah, actually, historical things regarding Spain. Anyway, the twisted viewpoint of Christian philosophies for the years, for many years after Jesus, for decades, actually, almost 1800 years, they purposely tried their best to avoid obeying anything the Torah told them to do. I find it funny, not in a funny way, but as an ironic and sick way, in that we're going through, teaching my kids about the conversos, the Spanish Inquisition, what it was doing, the individual characters, who did what to whom and why. We're reading those details for Hanukkah because it's the same principle of the conversos, were the Jews were not permitted to exist anymore during the Spanish Empire, during that time period. And so much like how the Maccabees also were not permitted to exist anymore as Jews, that is, during the Seleucid Empire, the Epiphanes Empires. So hence the comparison. And so the idea of applying laws and applying real practical applications was prohibited in Spain, actually. And if you, for example, they have a citation, the first person burned alive at the stake in Mexico, for being a Jew, he converted, you know, he was an infant, but he had told his second wife, his first wife was dead, his second wife, because she was on her menstrual cycle, said, maybe you shouldn't go to church today because you're in a menstrual cycle. Well, that resulted in his execution because he attempted to encourage her to stay home during menstrual cycle. Again, so the idea, it's bizarre, like, holy cow, that's crazy. But the Inquisition found out he said this, therefore he's burned alive at the stake, because how dare he apply any law written in the Torah to another human being. That was the idea. It was his own wife, and it was a private conversation, but a friar happened to overhear it, so he got himself killed for it, which is bizarre. We look at that, and that's crazy, right? It's a simple, hey, he was just saying maybe you shouldn't go, and that resulted in his brain burned alive, as well as a few other people who were his relatives. So it's kind of interesting that when we look at the Ten Commandments and how they actually apply to real life, real applications, the idea is that, okay, well, God encourages us to not just say, well, there's 10 laws. Well, there's more than 10 laws. There's 10 categories of laws. And then how are we going to use those in real life, to person, how we interact with people and interact with God? And so that's where a lot of this section in Exodus is going through, in the laws, how to deal with, for example, borrowed products or anything else that happens in things you may use or steal, in some cases, stealing, or of course, obviously, how we deal with slaves. Now, I'm going to spend the majority of my discussion about the slave concept, because I have it up here, you know, free versus slave here on my board behind me, because there's some comparisons that we can sometimes can confuse us as far as how we're looking at slavery and what God said about it, how the Israelites applied or didn't apply it. And then we're not discussing, by the way, I'm not discussing modern day slavery. That's not what I'm concerning about. I'm focusing strictly upon how the Bible discusses slavery and its subcategories, its subtleties behind it, because it has large ramifications to a believer in God and Jesus as far as how these things apply. So we've worked most of my time on that. If you have any questions on other stuff like, you know, stealing and robbing and whatnot, obviously we could talk about that too, but that's really not my primary discussion today. In Exodus 21, we go into this discussion about ordinances and places. The first passage, the very first verse, which I want to catch your attention to. This is traditional Jewish, so if you feel differently, that's fine, but I'm just reading a traditional Jewish concept behind this. It says, this very first verse, and these are the ordinances that you shall place before them. So stop there for a minute. Anytime in a Jewish philosophy or Jewish concept, when we look at the laws of God in the Torah, they are perceived or looked at as instructions from God. Much like I talked to my wife the other day, the idea that if I purchase a new appliance, let's say I bought an air fryer. Okay. It's just appliance I might use. Well, if I take the appliance and discard the instructions without reading them or applying them, what's going to happen to my use of the air fryer? It may or may not work, right? Something could go wrong with it. I could break it. I could cause a fire. Who knows what I might do, right? Similarly to other things, I may purchase a car. When I purchase a car, if I don't have the instructions how to operate the car, then I may struggle on how to operate a car, right? I may cause accidents or realize what parts, which pedal is a brake, which is the gas. I don't know, except for the instructions, right? The idea of if you don't read the instructions, you don't know how to actually do something. So our Torah is basically focused on an instruction booklet. And I say this first passage because these are the ordinances you place before them. In Jewish philosophy, when you give an instruction, a law, okay, it's not just here's the letter of the law and walk away. It doesn't work that way. It's here's the law, and then now here's how we understand the principle behind the law, how to use it and what its function is. That's really its goal. That's its target. When we discuss the laws of the Torah, the laws of Moses, or any law, or even instruction from Jesus, that is that not only am I telling you what's going on, I'm going to teach you, tell you what it says, what the rules are, teach you how to apply this at a principle concept on a broader spectrum. And the whole idea behind this in a Jewish philosophy, and for most part Christian too, though they vary a little bit on some concepts, is that if I teach you the principle behind it, then when you run into a situation that is different, a little odd or a little off than what you expected, or some new subtleties come in, you can say, okay, it doesn't quite fit the letter of the law exactly, but if I apply the principle behind the law, I can still more than likely get a correct answer as far as how to fix this problem. Kings would deal with that all the time. We call them the statutes or the orders or what they decree as an answer to a given problem. So we have, for example, the most famous one there is, right, was King Solomon and the two harlots, right, with the two babies and cut the baby in half in that one. One of the famous ones that King Solomon did. Well, if you look at the storyline, well, neither woman is honorable. They're both paid harlots, right? And in our Torah, that would be a reprehensible lifestyle or business to be in. So when we deal with these applications of laws and try to follow them in a real practical sense, when I have a principle behind it, I can more than likely get a good or reasonable answer for the instruction, what's happening. And that's the idea behind it. So in this Torah, in the Tanakh, which is the instructions of God, as we not only, that's not just laws, what do and what don't do, but how to apply them. When we place before the ordinances, the idea is the principle. Now let's discuss the idea of slavery. In the case of slavery, it discusses slaves are to be set free in the seventh year without paying or to go free after their time period, their freedom, and their debts unpaid. You may be a slave for a lot of reasons. Stealing, poverty, being sold for whatever reason. Those are the most common causes of slavery. In the case of a master of those slaves, our Torah in Exodus teaches something that is contradictory or strange to our thinking. One of the principal points we understand of slavery is the goal of a slave is to be free. It's the opposite of being a slave, right? So if our goal is to be free, and Apostle Paul just teaches that is, it is the objective or goal of any indentured servant to strive and work toward freedom. That's our job. That's our responsibility to work toward freedom. In the case of an Israelite slave who is biologically Israelite and their master is Israelite, there are rules in the Torah about how they are treated, how you must consider them, how you deal with their families compared to a Gentile, non-Israelite, who is treated differently. And the verse 2 and 3 discusses this idea. In the case of Israelite slaves, they're set free, which you understand that, without payment. I mean, they do not pay for their freedom. They are set free on a given time slot, the 7-year span. In the case of the master, if the slave comes to family, put yourself in the master's shoes temporarily. You are a master. You purchased a slave. Maybe he was a thief. Maybe he was just in extensive debt and could not support his family. Don't know. You purchased a slave and he has a wife and children. Well, guess what? As a master, you are responsible for not just the slave, but also the care of his wife and children. So in the case of this master-slave scenario, so this is a really interesting part. So I have a slave up here. I'm going to write slave here. So we have the slaves and the free. So free ones, we understand this is a hard thing to understand, but comprehend this. Just because you are a physical slave in a master's household does not mean you have no freedoms. You still have freedoms. But so we have a free slave versus a slave slave. So free slave versus slave slave. The free slave, Israelite, he may have a wife and children. So we have this guy, he has a wife, and we'll give him 2 kids. As a master, if I come and buy this guy, this particular slave, my responsibility is obviously to him, but he has a wife and kids. Well, if I just sit here and say, okay, you're my slave, I have you as my ownership, my responsibility to you. If I'm not paying him money, right, how is his wife and children going to survive? They don't. They'd starve to death. Wouldn't work. So in reality, when I come along in the slave market and say, hey, I see, we'll call him, you know, guy named Jay. I say, Jay, hey, I'm going to hire you. I'm going to buy you as a slave we'll give him 6 years. That's fine. He says, that's wonderful. It's worth whatever it is. Maybe his debt was making up. Okay. That's $100,000. All right. So I buy him for $100,000 and I have him as a slave, but he has a wife and kids. As master, I am not only responsible for his slave, $100,000 I'm willing to pay for him, but I also have to cover the expense of his wife and children to survive because he's Jewish. He's Israelite. That's how this works. So this is a whole family I am buying. I am not buying the work labor of his family. That may be part of the deal, a negotiation detail. If I can say, hey, I can't afford $100,000 for you, your wife, and your 2 kids. I can afford to pay for this. He'll say, okay, that's fine. Buy me for, I'll make this up, $60,000. Buy my wife for 40 type of thing. You could do it potentially that way to still get the $100,000 that then I as a master can at least utilize the wife and children to some instances. But either way, as a master, I'm responsible for all of them. Now let's go over to the slave, the Gentile slave. So same type of family, right? A slave is a Gentile, wife and 2 kids. This is a slave I buy forever. Right on this side over here. I don't have to say, well, you know, after the Israelite after you get rid of him after 6 years or whatever, this thing I have for forever. So I, as a master, I can say, well, you're actually worth a lot more to me financially because I'm not releasing you after 6 years. I could have a rate of return after, you know, maybe I get my money back after 6 years with the labor, but I can keep you on for, you know, that 20 or 30 years, however long you want to live, or I could sell you off. So being in this category, a slave type of slave is a far worse scenario for the slave, but better financially for the master. Credit a free slave, is a worse scenario for the slave, better for the slave, but a worse scenario for the master. So in these instances, we have as a master, which am I as a master likely to purchase? I'm going to choose to purchase the slave I get to keep longer versus this one. Because at least the slave I get to keep longer, I get not only my rate of return back, I'm going to keep him for a much longer period of time. I can start making money off the guy. And this one over here, I don't make much money. And the whole objective, God doesn't want you to have Israelite slaves. That's the objective. So he's not going to make it financially incentive to hire an Israelite slave, because this is financially ruinous to you as a master, but the other side. So that's a basic concept we're discussing about the slavery. Now we have this other discussion matter as far as how the slavery thing is elaborated and discussed in the purpose of how the functional application. Now I'm going to make these slaves wife and childless, okay? Now, this is a difficult thing to comprehend. In the case of a slave, we have an Israelite slave and we have a Gentile slave, okay? This slave will be there for so many years and then he's set free. The Gentile slave could be there for decades or a lifetime, depending on whatever, or we choose to sell him, whatever may happen here. And this is I, the master, I have two men. I could purchase either one of them. I can use them for different purposes as far as the tasks involved. I can't injure them, by the way. I can no permanent injuries. So I can't like discipline them to permanent injury. We'll discuss that shortly. This guy, the free slave, the Israelite slave, if I give him a woman, right? Hey, I'm going to have, here's a female you can have. She'd be your, I use the term loosely, quote, wife. It's really not technically a wife per se, because she's not free to choose. She's being given by the master. It's a different category. It's more like a more accurate description would be like a concubine as opposed to wife. So I can give my Israelite slave a concubine or both. I can give my the male slave, the Gentile slave, as a concubine, right? I can do either one. I own the concubine, this female slave. Now here's the kicker, or here's an important thing to understand here. This female slave is biologically not Israelite, period. Nothing else. She cannot biologically be part of the tribes of Israel, because you can't do that. You cannot take an Israelite female and give her as a concubine to a slave, whether he be Israelite or he be Gentile. You can't do that. That's against the law. She goes free if you attempt, with no questions asked. So this female is, in fact, we classify her, she be a Gentile slave. She's from this category of Gentile slaves. She's not an Israelite slave. That's the only way he could legally give her to anyone for that purpose. Now, it gives the example. Of course, the Israelite slave may say, you know what, you know, after 5 or 7 years, we should go free. I actually like this woman. I want to stay with her, keep her, have a wife, kids, whatever. And he may stay. That's his choice. And that's, which is fine. That's his decision to make. The other slave, the Gentile slave, don't have the option. The wife, the female slave, could be given to him or not given to him or even taken away. Any children produced because from the female, the relationships belong to the master. So we have kids. Because yeah, he's been with her for, you know, 5, 7 years, whatever it happens to be. She has a couple of kids. They all belong to the master in both categories. It doesn't matter. He, the Israelite slave, does not, but these all do. Then we look at this and say, well, this is weird. This is totally weird. I wouldn't like this. Who would want to do this? This is terrible. The emotions are being played with. Human lives are being messed with. This is strange. Why would God do this? Why wouldn't you say, just don't do it, right? The easy solution out. It's actually pretty simple. First of all, slaves are not going to go away. They aren't. No matter how many laws are passed in every country in the world, slaves are still fully active. There's lots and lots and lots of them. There's probably, I don't know, I think there's probably close to, I would not be surprised if we're near 500 million slaves in the world right now. There's a lot of slaves. And I truly mean slaves. I don't mean like indentured servants. I'm talking like slaves. If you attempt to flee, you're executed type of thing. We're talking slaves. So those are super common. The United States has a couple million in it. It's usually sex slaves is the most common one. They're not legal, but they're still done. Nobody stops it. Nobody successfully stops it, even though no matter how hard the government says. And of course, you have China, you have the actual like labor in the fields picking, you know, food and products. Those are slaves. If you attempt to leave, they get to labor, right? They shoot you or kill you because you're not allowed to leave. You're truly a slave. So in your housed in slave quarters. So there's lots of slaves in the world. Those aren't going away. And the point being that if you, let's pretend, you find yourself in some country somewhere in the future, I don't know, we'll make it up, country Schmobo. You go to country Schmobo, whatever it is, and Schmobo has slaves everywhere. We're all slaves. We got a slave. Slaves are on the street corners being sold by for pennies a dozen, right? And slaves are all over the place in this country Schmobo, and you're going to live there because for whatever reason you chose to live there. Well, in this country of slaves, because there are slaves there, you have a responsibility as a follower of God to treat slaves correctly and to advocate for their correct treatment, meaning godly treatment, whatever that happens to be. And so that's an important concept that we have to understand, that slaves aren't going away. God knew full well in the Torah, mankind was not going to get rid of slaves. We haven't. No matter what our laws say, we certainly have not, and we have no intention of successfully doing so. So knowing that slavery is still going to be alive and active, now it's been, 4,000 years thereabouts, 3,500 years, and they're still alive and active, still active and doing their thing. God's saying, yeah, you guys, human beings, are not going to get rid of slaves. They just won't do it. They're just too hell-bent on keeping them. So knowing they're hell-bent on keeping them, how do we treat them fairly? Now, so that's why it's kind of a weird concept to understand slavery, but this is how slavery has worked in our Bible. It's why our Torah gives us the rules about governing slavery and then what you can and can't do to them. Now, this part I want to know is really interesting to me. It may not be to you, but it is to me. So I have the slave say, I want to put the word Gentile up here, because that's really the category of what slave that true slave happens to be. They have no, they have some rights, but not a lot of rights over here, the Gentile slaves. So this was interesting to me. Is that okay? So I know that this female that was given as by the master, he belongs to the master, the children belong to the master, the slave as a Gentile slave, I may sell, or he may buy himself free, who knows what his means happen to be. The Israelite slave, similarly, I own the children, I own the wife, I don't own the guy, but he can get free after the 7 years, or on the seventh year, he goes free. So this is what I'm dealing with in this scenario. What would make him want to go free? Clearly, he doesn't like the girl. He didn't want her. Now he doesn't, they're not his anyway. At the same time, you have to figure this part out. This is important to understand. As the Israelite slave, which is a trick, this is a loophole in the Torah's laws. It's a purposeful loophole. God did it on purpose. So it's not like they had to work at it. It was specifically written in to do this. Book of Deuteronomy discussed the slave. When I, the master, set him free, I give him lots of money. I pay him. All right. So not only did I pay to buy him, when I set him free, I pay a whole bunch of money to set him free. I forgot the value. I think it's like 2 or 3 times the value of a hired servant for her service. Now, what options does he have with this newfound fortune? He could go off and go spend his life that he wants to do, or he could turn around, hey, master, I'm buying my wife and kids free. Yep, he can do that. That's totally legit. So in this free category, this free slave system, it's designed for the slave to be able to, he may or may not, this is his choice, be able to purchase his wife and kids the day he goes free. He didn't have to. He could say, I want to stay. That's fine. But he could also say, I'm going to buy them. And they're free too. So the design for the Israelite, it's designed in such a way that not only does the master risk losing his female slave, because he does, and any children coming from it, because the slave could then buy them off of him. He can make money off it. That's possible, of course. Depending on what the sale price happens to be. But it's designed to free this particular person, this female and her children. It's designed that way. It's perfectly designed that way. It's really well designed, actually. Because imagine he has 2 to 3 times the value of a hired servant. I'll make this up. Let's say you make 100 grand a year, which is a lot of money, by the way. 100 grand a year as a hired person. Well, this guy gets 2 or 3 times that. He gets $200,000 to $300,000. That's a fair amount of money to buy his wife and kids, isn't it? They may not be wealthy at the end of it, but if they're free, that's possible to do. And I, as a master, may or may not choose to sell it that way. It would be the same as purchasing any other slave once he is a free man. Correct, it is. It's the same concept. You can purchase any other slave once he's a free man. So he can be as he chooses to be. So this is his option. He's now a free man. He can just turn around the next hour. I'm free. Thank you, master. Turn around. I'm buying her, my 2 kids. Here's the money for it. Master says, okay. The master walks away with essentially keeps his money. For all practical purposes, he winds up keeping it overall. And it's in a sense, the female and the children go free too. They could, I don't know what he's going to do for his life at this point on. That's between him and his family and what his means may be, but he has this capability. The other side, however, does not have that option because he doesn't go free. This is not an Israelite slave. This is a Gentile slave. He's stuck. This is a hard problem to be, but the family is still belongs to the master. So in this system, it's really, again, designed for me as a master to really not want to purchase an Israelite slave. That is the Torah's objective. It is not in my best interest, really, to purchase an Israelite slave ever. It's my best interest to retain Gentiles and all, but not the Israelite slave. Because no matter what, I have a higher chance of losses, my financial loss. I'm paying not only to buy him for the debt he owes, but also I'm paying him when he leaves. I have the risk of losing the female and the children that come off of that also when he leaves. I have all these high risks on this end. And the whole point, don't own a slave. What's God's objective? Don't own a slave, of Israel at least. So that's how we're doing this discussion matter. There's a few other things we can discuss about this topic, and that when the apostles discuss this and when Jesus discusses this concept, not in the extensive that he covers it normally, but he covers this topic fairly well in the concept of this slave idea. Because we have obviously the Torah portion discussing you can't kidnap a slave type thing. Those are all death penalties examples. We'll discuss the death penalty later. But in the case of rectifying this, how do I rectify this scenario over here with the Israelite, which totally I can understand. I see how God manipulated this law in such a way to get this Israelite and his family free. I can see that. That's pretty obvious. But my God is a God of love and freedom and trying to end oppressions. So how to rectify this half, the Israelite half, put a big Israel up here, Israel. I can spell Israel. Anyway, Israel up here, how to rectify this side versus the God of love for this side, the Gentile. Yeah, what? Just sucks to be you type of thing. You don't want to be the Gentile slave. But how do I get out of it? Let's pretend I was, born into it. Who knows? Maybe I was a kid and I was born into the slave at some point in time. Or maybe I was caught by a roving band of like slave traders. Who knows? Whatever the case may be, I was captured and I became myself a slave. How do I get out of being the slave? Right? What are my options? Well, obviously I can't be an Israelite. That's not really an option because I'm not biologically them. But how do I get this? I don't get an Israelite wife because they're not allowed to be given to me. How do I get out of this scenario? How do I get myself free for God of love? Why doesn't he love this guy over here? Well, actually, technically, he sort of does. It's just done differently. In the way which the Gentile slave, he doesn't have the same options as the Jewish slave or the Israelite slave does. But the Gentile slave does have one tool in his tool belt, which is permanently his as long as he lives, okay? He is a Gentile, right? But what makes you a Gentile versus what makes you an Israelite? It's not just biology. What's the second avenue of becoming an Israelite that's not related to biology? Choice. That's the difference. So this slave, male slave, can be a slave. However long he's a slave, I don't really know. However long he wishes to be a slave. He has a choice. The God of Israel. He came from a Gentile background. But there's no law that says he has to stay his religious belief system, right? We also have rules in the Torah regarding Passover, keeping the holy days, that Israelite masters have to obey with their servants. Their servants get Saturdays off, right? The servants can participate in the holy days if they're circumcised, right? So all those are laws that govern this Gentile slave, as well as choices the Gentile slave has at his disposal. The moment he says, I am not going to be a Gentile anymore, I'm going to follow the God of Israel, and this is what I want. This is what I'm going to believe in and be part of. Guess what? According to the laws of Moses, he's not actually categorized as Gentile anymore. He's now a sojourner among you. once we go sojourn among you, guess what? Bingo, dollar signs, rules change. You went from this category, this Gentile slave, and jumped ship, became an Israelite slave. Again, now what's the objective of God? Again, to be free. That's a goal. Be free, be free, be free. Don't be oppressed. Don't be owned. We want to be free. Okay, Gentile slave, you want to stop being a slave anymore. You want to be free. Change your God. And God gives you a pathway to set you free. See that works? Follow your God. Follow the God of Israel, and he will give you the pathway to be free. That's the beauty behind it. What is then the objective, not the master, but the objective of God when it comes to slavery? The slavery is, okay, you got a slavery for whatever reason, whether you were Israelite, got in the debt, a Gentile captured, whatever reasons you became a slave, God provides a way to freedom for you in every scenario, all right? Doesn't matter where you're at. If you're the female slave, right? The female slave scenario given, well, yeah, if you're given to one of the slaves, who knows which one, whether it's a male, a Gentile or not, what is your methodology of getting free? Hey, hubby, I have a plan. Here's the plan, dear. And we'll discuss this process of getting us from this category of the Gentile slave shifted over to the Israelite slave free side. That's the goal. So it's all designed to transfer, to incentivize Gentile slaves. Say, I want to go this way. I want to go over here to this category. It's all designed to shift these guys from this kind of Gentile slave and design, if you want freedom, shift over to here. And guess what? Freedom is now a way out. You get freed from your misery, from your difficulties. Now, I don't know for certain how many, or if any, really, for that matter, chose this route, this pathway, or even how many slaves were actually treated fairly according to Torah. Probably not a lot, because human beings are not really Torah observant overall. But the point is, as far as the laws are concerned, God designed a law system to get slaves to get out free. The requirement, you have to believe in God, which is really not that absurd of a concept. Because what's God's goal? Know the truth. Know what's real. Know what's factual. Not your idols of whatever you came from. So this is all designed that way. So I have to think it's actually, even though it's, we think of, oh no, God has laws about slavery. How awful. Why did he eliminate slavery? The goal isn't to eliminate slavery because it's not going to go away. It's still alive. The idea is, how do you become no longer a slave and become free? Find the pathway to get free. Yeah, we have discussion also, which I won't go to just yet, or might do it to later, regarding the nature of what Paul discusses. As a slave, your objective is to always strive for freedom in whatever means possible. That was Paul's instruction, which is, again, human nature. We want to be free. So if you're, Paul has discussed this actually a number of times regarding Gentile slaves, is that the goal of this, your goal, Gentile slave, is to be free. So whatever means gets you free, be free. Well, according to the Torah, there's one surefire path getting you free. Become a follower of God of Israel, and you have your freedom route. Assuming your master, of course, is also a follower of the God of Israel. If he's somebody else, then that's a different problem. That's his own, actually, miserable issue. So, and I won't discuss that today because that's outside the scope of the Torah's discussion. So in the case of the sale of an Israelite girl, when the Israelite girl becomes a slave, I mentioned before, it is not permitted by the master for him to give her an Israelite female as a slave's wife. It can't happen. Not allowed. That's against the Torah. When he buys her as a slave, it is either for himself as a wife or for his son as a wife. That's really it. Or sons. He made more than one son. But one of his sons, that's the wife function. So he treats her as a daughter. So he may cost him a lot of money, whatever it was, to buy this girl. But as she grows up and becomes of age to marry, if he says, hey, I want to marry her, or I don't want to marry her, or it's for my son, he doesn't want to marry her, she goes free. He's out of the money. It was a gamble at his end to do so. So female Israelites are not treated the same as Gentile females. They don't have the same scenario. They're just set free if anything goes wrong. So it's very, it's again, a risky thing. The master doesn't know exactly what he's getting when he goes that route. So this is how we rectify this, how I rectify at least, the God of love, the God of mercy and forgiveness, how I rectify how he did this in our Torah. He did it to the Zionists to get everybody, including Gentile slaves, to believe in him. That is his ultimate goal here, to believe and trust in him. Hope you don't lose anybody in that. We'll come back to that a little bit later as it is addressed in Jeremiah 34 and a teeny amount in the 1 Corinthians. So we have a few other details on this before I move on with this. We have this rules about, you know, killing and slaughter and how you treat people and penalties and such. I want to draw your attention to one thing which is relevant to the slavery category. Is if you'll notice in your verse like 12 through, what is it? 17, I think it is. It discusses like murder, including killing of a slave, but murder in general, right? Slaughtering of somebody, manslaughter versus murder, and you don't get to let manslaughters go free. A killer, accidental killer, obviously, but not necessarily a premeditated manslaughter. And the penalty, of course, is death for that murderer. And I find it interesting that God included, I'll leave this, it's up here, I'll erase part of it real quick because I need a little space to write. So God, in the case of murder, we also have slaves can be killed too, which we'll discuss that shortly because there's a trick in that verse, which I'll mention in a minute. We have the case of if I'm the master, I was punishing whatever and they die. But so we have the murders, so premeditated murder. Oh, that's an ER, not a UR. ER. Manslaughter, which is different. I'm misspelling it terribly. Bad penmanship. Slaughter. Manslaughter. And they also, God points out, there's kidnapping. And then we have cursing parents. Now, we don't usually in our modern culture equate all of these, right? Murder and kidnapping and cursing parents is an executable offense. And you're like, huh, really? Yeah. We don't usually think, okay, he murdered somebody. He killed somebody. Kill him. Well, this guy, he curses parents. Kill him. But whoa, those are very different, right? A lot of teenagers curse their parents out of just a hothead moment. They go, oh, death penalty. Well, no, not exactly. They're under 20. But still, all those people in the world, you're right, they were me. But the idea, of course, is God is equating these concepts like, well, this is not part of Western philosophies or ideas of justification for killing somebody. We don't include kidnapping as a executable offense. But God, of course, does. But God's premeditated murder, kidnapping, and cursing parents are all executable offenses. So you think, okay, kidnapping, cursing parents, they're harder for us in our Western culture to see, oh, these are all the same. Well, God, he sees them as the same. And the idea in some ways, this is how I interpret this, you may disagree, which is fine, is that God is trying to point out cursing your parents or kidnapping somebody are serious offenses. Those are serious crimes, not to be taken light of, right? They matter. They're similar to murder, as murdering somebody. And the idea is that, hey, you shouldn't do kidnapping. You should not curse your parents. You should not premeditatedly murder somebody. These are important things to be highly offensive. You do not do them. So he's grouping them together in a category of, whoa, these are really important. I, as a human being, should elevate the level of cursing parents to be equivalent to murdering somebody. Hence, I would not murder somebody, therefore I would not curse their parents. Same kind of idea. So if God's elevating these, he has his reasons why he elevates them. I'm not going to sit there and, you know, condemn all the teenagers in the world who got mad at their moms and dad for something. They couldn't go to the party, they got grounded, whatever, and they cursed their parents out of sheer anger. I will not argue what they should or shouldn't happen to them. But the point is, it's interesting that God has elevated these to this category. Now, God does make an interesting carve-out in the case of slaves. I find this interesting carve-out because it's counterintuitive with regards to both the Israelite slave or the Gentile slave, but God still makes this carve-out for the murder thing. I will discuss kidnapping and cursing parents. It's just for you to conceptually think about how important kidnapping and cursing parents are to God, hence we don't do them. But let's discuss the idea of murder a little bit for this slave. So I have this slave, we'll call the Gentile slave, and I beat him with a rod of iron, or a rod. So I didn't say iron, just beat him with a rod. Now, me as a master, okay, here's an important Jewish viewpoint. This is the rabbinical, rabbis have talked about this for a long, long, long time. This is how they interpret this word. You may not think this way, but this is how they interpret the words. If I, as a master, am saying, I have to discipline a slave, you know, because he did something wrong, whatever it is, I have to discipline it. So I take a rod, my disciplining rod, and I smack him over the back or the head or whatever it is, right? He's, ow, that hurts. Okay, I won't do it anymore. Great, problem solved. So the discipline tool. Now, here's an important concept, which is what Judaism is very, very strict on when it comes to slave corrections. You are not permitted to use a lethal tool to discipline your slave. So for example, if I have a rock in my hand, that can be a lethal tool. Not that I may use that way, but it can be one. Therefore, I am no longer disciplining my slave. I am actually causing permanent or possibly death potential to my slave. Now I'm considered a murderer. So the idea is that the slave being beaten and injured or die is that, hey, I was using a tool that was not meant to be lethal, hence the rod. It's usually a wooden rod. They're not designed to be lethal. And it accidentally or unintentionally became lethal. Oops, I was just trying to discipline him and I hit the thing and it happened to hit, I don't know, his kidney by accident. And I didn't know he had one good kidney, one bad one. I hit the good one and it died. Now he dies from some horrible thing. The idea was being unintentional, right? That was the idea behind it. So Judaism, they're very strict. You cannot use any tool that could cause lethality. It has to be a non-lethal tool when it comes to disciplining anybody, whether it be a slave or another human being, must be non-lethal. And so that's how they interpret it. So if I, as a slave owner, beat my slave because I was disciplining him, he did something wrong. Maybe he, I don't know, whatever he did, I did something and he died. It was assumed because it was a non-lethal tool. It was unintentional. Therefore, I, as a master, don't necessarily die. If, however, I, as a master, choose to use a lethal tool, like it can kill people. It's designed to kill people if necessary. And I use that slave, that's not considered disciplining. I'm now classified as a premeditated murderer, even though he's my slave. Now, I'm not saying that you may agree with this philosophy. I'm just pointing out this how rabbinical teachers have interpreted this concept since before Jesus was born. They would argue this is what it means. You cannot use a lethal tool in this concept. So when it doesn't matter whether a slave is Israelite or Gentile, non-lethal tools are permitted for disciplining, but nothing that is lethal can be used. Else it jumps from a slave and master scenario to a master premeditated murder scenario, regardless of the slave is Gentile or not. So you may disagree with that philosophy or not, but that's how they've interpreted it. And Apostle Paul did say, again, the Jews were given the oracles of God, therefore they have the right to interpret conflicting or questionable passages. So I'll defer to them and say, okay, that's fair. I can understand that concept. So non-lethal tools are permitted for beating slaves. You cannot use a lethal tool for that purpose in their teachings. So again, contrast all this stuff just as you're contemplating this around in your head, mulling it over in your head. Contrast this idea of these slaves and how this process is supposed to work. Contrast this to how a foreign or a different nation would treat slaves. At this time in history, as far as when the Torah is being written, we have a very different idea of how a different nation would treat slaves, as far as compared to what Israel's doing slaves. We see this as more of a hard idea for us as our modern world, but we don't, if we compare this to, for example, Hittites or the Egyptians or anybody else who had slaves, we say, whoa, if I was going to be forced to be a slave and be sold, I want to be sold to an Israelite master, not just any Israelite, who is obedient to God. He must obey God. Obey. Not just any master. Somebody who actually is obedient to God. I would, if I'm going to be forced as a slave, I would like to be a slave of that category versus any other category there is. And it's almost like an incentivization. Thank you. Is that if I would end up being sold, let's say I get the debt, whatever, I'd be sold, I'm trying to flee to Israel. So, okay, sell me here. Higher chance of being an option out compared to any other country I get sucked away into, like Egypt, which keeps slaves for forever and generationally. Okay, hopefully didn't lose you so far on this idea of slave and these kidnappings and how this process works. If my slave runs away, by the way, that is a gray area. Meaning it's unclear in our Torah if that's classified as kidnapping for certain or not. If they're a Gentile slave, it is. If it's Israelite slave, for certain it's kidnapping. If I kidnap and bring it back, it's unclear if I recapture my runaway slave who is a Gentile, whether or not that's kidnapping or not. I say unclear means a little bit open to interpretation. I happen to interpret kidnapping across the board as just blanket kidnapping, because kidnapping a man is what's the Torah's concern. So if a slave runs away, I can't go kidnap him and bring him back. That would be against, or hire somebody, I should say, not kidnapping. I cannot go hire someone to kidnap and bring him back. I may go pursue him and get him, but I can't hire somebody else to do it for me. That's kidnapping. So that would result in the execution of me if I did that. So it would not be my interest as a slave owner to hire someone to recapture my slave. It would be resulting in my death penalty, which is not a good plan for me. It's a short, you know, retirement type of plan. Anyway, so moving forward, we don't lose anybody so far in this concept of how these slaves processes work. In the case I mentioned before about the non-lethal weapon being used for disciplining slaves, if I use a potentially lethal weapon, let's pretend, for the sake of discussion, I use a big, massive rod. Big, old, massive rod. Do rods hurt? Yes. Can rods break things on a person's body? Yes. They can break external features. As opposed to, you can injure your head or your body part or spleen. Something can cause a permanent injury. So I have a master. If I'm a master and I come along and I hit my slave because I'm mad at him. Again, this is one of the reasons why Jews said you can't use lethal tools or tools that are designed to cause like serious injuries. Because if you do that, number one, you might kill him. That's bad. You're causing murder if you murdered somebody intentionally by using a lethal tool. But number two, if you injure him, permanently injure him in any way, he's set free. Done. End of story. So again, it gives support to the Jewish philosophy of you can't use a lethal weapon because lethal weapons cause permanent injuries. Non-lethal don't. If I'm going to use like a willow switch, it's not like it causes permanent injury unless I really, really work at it, okay? It may cause hurt, but not permanent stuff, right? So swapping your kids with a willow switch, for example. So using non-lethal or even like, you know, even a belt is not as bad. But the non-lethal part is because if you use a lethal weapon, it's potential to cause permanent injury. Slave goes free if that happens. And would that be the master's best interest? Of course not. Would not be interested to go free. So it gives some support to their philosophy about even when it comes to disciplining. Hence, we have if you injure the eye or injure the tooth or whatever, the slave goes free for the injury because you can't do any kind of permanent injuries. Again, remember, the whole objective for God is to let you go free. If I have a bad master who's causing injury, what happens? I go free. If I have a good master who teaches me about, you know, the Torah, and I learn about God, I can go free. If I flee away because the master is being abnormally brutal to me, he kidnaps me, master's killed, and I go free. A lot of scenarios where I, as a slave, can get free. Now, if I happen to have this Torah point, the slave really loves his master, the master's great to him, he loves his wife, loves everybody, doesn't want to go free, that's fine. Obviously, he's a good person, a good master, and that's great. But that's the choice of the individual to choose at that point in time if they happen to be Israelite, which is all positive in its nature. So I encourage you to look at slavery when it comes to Torah's concerned. Think of it more of the nuances of the slave rules. Those nuances control or can influence our concept of how slave works, how slave does not work, and how it should work as far as a God, he's sort of loosely godly master slave scenario. He's loosely because it's a strange concept to think about. I'm going to shift over from this to Jeremiah because something super critical happened in the book of Jeremiah, which I'm disappointed this Torah portion only covered the first half of Jeremiah 34 because the punchline is in the last half of Jeremiah 34, not the first half. The first half was the setup and the punchline is the last half, which just blows the whole story out of the water, which I'm disappointed didn't cover that, but we'll talk about it a little bit. So if I don't lose anybody on this concept, I'm going to move forward to narrow focus into the Israelite slaves during Jeremiah's day, King Zedekiah, that was in it was in charge at the time when that happened. So I'm going to erase some of this and move forward with that. Okay. In the case of Jeremiah 34, we have a particular scenario. I'm going to erase just some of this because I'm going to sell my picture up here of this Israelite slaves. They are biologically Israelite followers of God. However you want to word it, and so they are semi-free but semi-not. So this slave scenario in Jeremiah 34. Let's jump to Jeremiah 34 and discuss a little bit about what's going on in this story, because this gives a whole nother perspective or viewpoint of God when it comes to slavery in general as a whole. This is why Judaism is, I think, reasonably smart when it comes to this topic. They have a lot of information with this. They're not dumb. They've thought this thing through pretty thoroughly. So Jeremiah 34, you have King Zedekiah. And King Zedekiah, of course, is the king of Judah. He has been, at this point in the book of Jeremiah, it's toward the latter section of Jeremiah. And it's the latter end before, it's not exactly before, but super close to when the final exile takes place and Jerusalem is evacuated. There'll be a few things that happen between this Jeremiah 34 and later on, but that's a portion of that time. So at this point in the story of Jeremiah, Nebuchadnezzar has already come multiple times. His dad came once, he's come once before, he's coming again. He's got multiple, and he takes people out of Judah regularly. He captures large quantities, hauls them off to Babylon, obviously killing a lot of people in the form of a war because of your battle that you're fighting. He's doing this regularly. So it's a regular occurrence. Zedekiah is currently king at this point in time in the storyline for Jeremiah 34. And he's not a very good one. He's a pretty awful king, actually. But that's just who he happens to be. So this goes through in Jeremiah 34, this goes a unique scenario that takes place. It says when, this is verse 1, came to Jeremiah from the Lord, when Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and all of his army, all the kingdoms of the earth under his dominion, and all the peoples fought against Jerusalem and all its cities, saying, this is the Lord says. So at this storyline, we have Nebuchadnezzar. I want to draw a quick map here. So we have Israel. Yeah, Jerusalem, somewhere around here, right? This spot of Israel, obviously down here is this is Sinai Peninsula. And then you have, you get down to Egypt, and you have over here, you have the Syrian and Babylonian off on that side of the map. And you have modern day Saudi Arabia, which is at this point in time, the storyline is partially Edom. Edomites are still there, but they're in the process of migrating from that territory to southern Israel. So Edom's, half of them have migrated, half of them but not. Anyway, so Nebuchadnezzar is surrounded Jerusalem. There's a few of the most cities he's taken, and he has most of the country, not Egypt necessarily, most of the countries of nations around him surrounded to have Jerusalem surrounded at this point in time. So Zedekiah is still king. He's not lost per se. Now, they have lost, by the way, many times, but he's still being left or has been allowed to stay or remain as king, and he's been replaced a few times, in the process of each of the times Jerusalem got taken, and got taken a few different times. Not taken in like burned taken, but taken as like they had to surrender for a while, taken, but ever since Hezekiah and onward. It's happened in a number of different scenarios at this point in Jeremiah's story. So this was happening, this time slot. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, go speak to Zedekiah, the king of Judah, and tell him, thus says the Lord, behold, I will give the city to the hand of the king of Babylon, and he shall burn it with fire. All right, pretty straightforward, right? So Jerusalem, you're going to fall. Definitely going to fall. Not a problem. We understand that concept. And you, Zedekiah, shall not escape from his hand, but shall surely be taken and delivered into his hand. Your eyes shall see the eyes of the king of Babylon. He shall speak with you face to face, and you shall go into Babylon. Yet hear the word of the Lord, O Zedekiah, king of Judah. Thus says the Lord concerning you. You shall not die by the sword, but you shall die in peace as in the ceremonies of your fathers, the former kings who were before you. So they shall burn incense for you and lament for you, saying, alas, O Lord, for I have pronounced the word, says the Lord. So at this point in time, the God is prophesying Zedekiah. Zedekiah, by the way, is not a very good king. He's pretty awful of a human being. He's saying, hey, you're going to go in the king, you're going to go to Babylon, you're going to die in peace there, as opposed to, you know, here in Jerusalem or here in Israel. But beyond that, not much else bad will happen to you. So you'll die there for the most part. You're going to see destruction and such and lament for you, but overall, you're going to die in peace, which is actually not a bad thing. If you're looking at kingship and being in charge of a whole nation, that God's saying, hey, you're going to die, every dies, of course, but it won't be awful for you. You'll be okay. It won't be a great death, but it won't be an awful one either. It could be like really torturous death, right? It won't be that way. You'll die in peace. Sounds great, but huge, massive but shows up. Jeremiah, the prophet, spoke all these verses to Zedekiah, the king of Judah, in Jerusalem. When the king of Babylon's army fought against Jerusalem with all the cities of Judah that were left against Lachish and Azekah, for only these fortified cities remained of the cities of Judah. This is a time slot, so Babylon has surrounded Jerusalem. There's only a few cities left to fight, right? The word of the Lord to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, after King Zedekiah had made a covenant with all the people who were at Jerusalem to proclaim liberty to them, that every man should set free his male and female slave, a Hebrew man or woman, that no one should keep a Jewish brother in bondage. Pause. Okay, so now we have an edict. So God gave this information to Jeremiah, and Jeremiah relayed the information to Zedekiah, and Zedekiah did something. He did something about it. So we have, I'm going to put, you know, erase a little bit of this because I have no space here. So Zedekiah is freeing all the Israelite slaves. So freeing the slaves. Now, this is an important idea. He's freeing slaves. Now, he's dictating that every owner of a slave, all the masters, have to release their Hebrew slaves, which they're supposed to release anyway every 7 years. But as I mentioned before, you can't necessarily say that everybody obeyed the laws of God, though they're supposed to. It doesn't mean they said they did. So he makes this covenant agreement with all of them, all the people who own slaves, of course, at Jerusalem to proclaim liberty to them. And then verse 9, that every man should free his slave. Verse 10. Now, when all the princes and all the people who had entered the covenant heard that everyone should set free his male and female slaves, that no one should keep them in bondage anymore, they obeyed and let them go. So great, they did something. Now, this is a really important concept. For those of you who don't understand this idea, just think about it. It's an idea of you to understand, because it's important to see this, how this process works. We mentioned before, the laws of slaves in the Torah, right? So Torah has laws. The laws of slavery can only apply when you have a slave, right? Let's say for me, for example, I, Daniel Agee, I do not own any slaves. Do I then obey the laws of slavery? Well, actually, they don't apply because I don't have any slaves. I wouldn't want one, but the point is, they don't have any. So the laws of slaves or freedom or the Gentile or Israelite only apply when you actually have a slave, or you can advocate for somebody else who owns a slave to try to teach them better, right? But if I don't own one, I can't really obey that law of the Torah because it doesn't apply. It's like the laws of the menstrual cycles don't apply to me. Why? I'm not a girl. It doesn't work, right? There's certain things that it doesn't apply to me. It may apply to somebody else, but not necessarily to me. So there's certain things I can apply, things I can't apply. So when you have a nation, in this case, it was a city technically, but still, Jerusalem has a rules. Okay, all Israelite slaves set free. You are not permitted to own an Israelite slave anymore. That you can't own a Gentile slave, but you can't own an Israelite slave. Okay, so now the king made a ruling that was the case. So they all had to go free. So in this case, the laws regarding Israelite slaves and how they're treated differently than Gentile slaves at this point in Jerusalem would no longer apply. Essentially, he didn't erase a law. He made it non-effective. So it's like, for example, as I mentioned before, the male and female for menstrual cycles, right? It's not the menstrual cycle law doesn't apply for my life. It's just that it doesn't affect me because it doesn't do anything for me. It may affect my wife, my kids, my daughters, but it doesn't affect me directly. The law is still there. It just doesn't apply to me directly. So hope that makes sense what I'm trying to say. So in the case of a slave, I said a slave free, given to slaves, and let's say I had slaves at the time and I don't anymore, the laws governing Israelite slaves no longer affect me anymore, or the slaves themselves, the Israelite slaves themselves, the laws don't affect them. So it's a way of negating the effectivity of a law of the Torah by making it not apply. It's not needed anymore. It's an unnecessary component. The law is not functional. It's a non-functional scenario. There's a lot of laws or Torah that don't apply anymore directly, meaning, for example, the laws of offering sacrifices. You don't have a temple. You can't do them anyway. That's the law what erased. It didn't get erased. It made its effectivity go away. You can't be functionally operated, functionally used, because you don't have a temple. You don't have an altar. Slavery is the exact same way. You can obliterate or delete the laws of slavery by obliterating slavery in your nation, which is great. That's a positive thing. You get rid of slaves. That's great. God likes, you know, freedom all across the board. They did this wonderful. Verse 11. But afterward, they changed their minds and made the male and female slaves return, whom they had set free, and brought them into subjection as male and female slaves. Therefore, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, pause there for a minute. So they effectively removed a law setting everyone free. They don't owe you as a master any money. They just go free. If I re-enslave them, what have I done? I've kidnapped them, a free person, and brought them back into slavery, which they didn't deserve. They didn't have a need. They were free. They didn't owe any money. They were set free. So what did I do? I just essentially committed a crime worthy of murder. Remember before I said murder, kidnapping, cursing parents are all death penalty crimes? That's what I just did. I did a death penalty crime. This is the problem. You can't do that. And so God then changes his whole storyline. Mentioned before that King Zedekiah would die in peace. We didn't continue on reading because it stops at verse 14 for the Torah portion of the section. But if you advance forward to verse 21, which I'll read here just now, because it's really important that God essentially changed the outcome. This event by re-enslaving them changed the outcome description that God gave to Zedekiah. He had influence over his outcome. He didn't obey the influence. Jump to verse 21 of that says that chapter says, and I will give Zedekiah, king of Judah, and his princes in the hand of their enemies, in the hand of those who seek their life, and in the hand of the king of Babylon, army which has gone back from you. Behold, I will command, says the Lord, and cause them to return to the city. They will fight against it and take it and burn it with fire. I'll make the cities of Judah and desolation without inhabitant. So God went from, okay, Babylon had you surrounded. Zedekiah makes a decree. Everybody goes, all the Israelite slaves go free. Babylon's army leaves. They left. They were gone. They went away. This event by setting them free took the entire army away from Jerusalem. That's amazing. God said, okay, you did something good in my eyes. I'm going to take the pressure from Babylon away from you. And then they flip. And God says, that screeching halt. Stop. Flip around Babylon. Go burn them. Crush them. It tells me that I, as a human being, have a lot more control over the details of what God gives me than I imagine. If I do right and do good, I can alter the outcome of my future. I can't live forever. As far as the immediate consequence of what's happening, I can change them. We call this in Christianity, we call it repentance. That is, you can change what the consequence are. God, I'm sorry, this is something wrong, but change this. And then God can say, okay, good job. Because you changed this, I'm going to think God shows mercy. So God showed them mercy by pulling Babylon away from Jerusalem after they made this decree. But then once they rescinded and recaptured, re-kidnapped them, brought them back into slavery, said, okay, stop. I'm going to flip it again, bring Babylon back over and crush you and burn you and destroy you. Now, Zedekiah, he does temporarily see Nebuchadnezzar eye to eye before he gets his eyes plucked out. So, and he dies in prison. And after, of course, he gets all of his kids murdered in front of him while he can still see. Then Nebuchadnezzar takes his eyes, removes them, shackles, and puts him in prison until he dies in prison. Dying in prison as a blind man and having all of your children murdered before your eyes is not dying in peace, is it? We die in sorrow, in misery. So God went from verse 5, Zedekiah, you will die in peace in Babylon, to no, you're going to die in misery in Babylon. So God essentially made the consequence from it was going to be one way, Then you, Zedekiah, change the outcome by freeing people. Great, I'm gonna leave now, bring Babylon away. You sit there and re-enslave people. I'm gonna bring Babylon back because you re-enslave them. And I'm gonna make it worse for you than had you not done anything at all. If you'd not done anything at all, you'd just been die in peace in Babylon and wherever where you were in Babylon, you'd have died in peace. But because you did something good and then reversed it, made it even worse, now I'm gonna make it worse on you. Your consequence is more severe than it would have been had you just not done anything at all. It'd been better off because you wouldn't have died quite as miserable, because that is not dying in peace. Yeah, you're not being slaughtered by a sword, but it's still not dying in peace. Seeing your whole all your children slaughtered for you, eyes plucked out, thrown in prison, shackled there till you die, that's not peace. That's misery. That's awful. That's the type of scenario it is. So I'm going to end there. I'm over time. I apologize for that. I won't go into 1 Corinthians at all. I took too long on these. But I want to understand the idea of we as people have the ability to both get free from our bondages in many ways. Whether you're Gentile or Israelite makes a difference. You can change what you believe, what you follow. And you can also change, as we see from Zedekiah, the outcome of consequences. What consequences you're experiencing can be altered by your behavior. You can improve or make them worse by your behavior, how you respond to God and what is right versus what is wrong. As I mentioned before, when I started out, Moses gives us not just the laws, it's the principle behind the law. So you have a scenario that's a little different or a little doesn't quite fit just right. If you understood the principle, in this case, freeing slaves, and the principle God's objective is free slaves, understand that concept, then you can apply it in a positive way and affect a whole lot of people, including yourself and the outcome you live through. Does that make sense? Hopefully I didn't lose anybody on this. I know it's a lot to throw at you at once, but any questions or comments or things you didn't understand, I'm over time, so I do apologize for that, but these are kind of interesting things to me. Oh, you turned the volume back up? That's better.
I missed it. Now, did Zedekiah, was he the one who said, oh, it's okay now, go and get your slaves back, or was it the people that said... that just went and said, I'm not going to obey anymore. I'm going to go get my slave.
Interesting question. The king, as Zedekiah, he has the authority to enforce any covenant. So if he goes to nobles, say, nobles, set them free, and they choose not to, the king has the ability to say, no, I said set them free. I'm going to enforce this upon your death because you just tried to kidnap these people back again. King Zedekiah did not do that, did not enforce his covenant. His covenant had no teeth behind it. He was not willing to enforce it. It's like how the police officer can enforce a speeding law, a speeding ticket. Say, you went 90 in a 25 zone. I'm not going to ticket you because I like the color of your car. Well, then that's not enforcing a law, is it? Who's at fault? Both you as well as the police officer who don't enforce it. So in God's case, he's pointing out that, hey, the nobles, which is all your relatives, Zedekiah, and people who are also important, you had the ability to enforce the law, Zedekiah, against them, but you didn't. So you are, in fact, guilty. Even though he may personally have not re-enslaved the Israelites, he did not enforce the agreement he made. Therefore, the agreement makes it null and void, and he acquiesced or allowed the re-enslavement to occur without trying to stop or doing anything about it. So whether or not he physically did it or did not, he failed to do the one thing a king's job is to do, enforce the law. He failed to do so. He didn't want to for whatever his reasons are. Any other questions or comments?
Yeah, I just was thinking that you cannot reach completion by your works because you have to have faith, and I'm thinking faith without works is dead. So somewhere you have to have the right works.
Right. Right. You have to actually use them. You have to actually do something about your faith. You may believe, we have a sticker on our refrigerator says your beliefs don't make you a better person, your behavior does. But you actually do. You have to believe and actually do something about it. Not just say the words and say, be good. Like that whole, that fake, she didn't actually say it, but it's attributed to her falsely, that, let them eat cake. I can't think of her, the Marie Antoinette's, right? Let them eat cake. Well, she didn't actually say those phrases, but she said something different. But the point is, you can say it all you want. There isn't any food. What good does it say, go let them eat cake when there's no food? It's useless, right? So the words don't mean anything if they have no teeth behind it. Your faith doesn't mean anything unless you do something about it. They go hand in hand. They're tied together. You have to act out the faith. That's important. Any comments or questions?
Yeah, I was wondering, is that it seems like the picture that was painted about the Israelite slave in the 7 years and then turning him free, those types of imagery, and then even the Gentile who then professed his belief in the God of Israel, and how then the rules would change. He'd be a sojourner, and then how the laws that were spoken to the Israelites regarding the sojourner. It seems like a lot of that was leading up to the spiritual freedom or getting a new heart, being free from the prison and the bondage of sin through Yeshua HaMashiach, our great high priest, our mediator, and our king. It seems like those things were leading up to him coming. And so I was thinking about that because I've met with people who were actually slaves who were born again. I mean, had the Spirit of God living in them and had a new heart with the law written on it. And even though that they were oppressed, they were free. Meaning they were spiritually free, and they didn't have the anger and the bitterness and the resentment that would come if you were in bondage under a master. And I just thought that that was really profound.
Yeah. That's an excellent observation. You're right. This is all a setup. It's all a setup for the spiritual concept, which Apostle Paul talks with the letter to Philemon about, hey, you have a slave that's coming back to you, but he's not really a slave. He's a fellow believer. Well, if he's a fellow believer, he's now your brother. The idea that this slavery thing is a bondage concept, and the New Testament authors, the apostles as well as Jesus, play with that a number of times in their passages about setting the captives free, the dropping of bondage to sin or transgression or demons or and idol worship. All those are bondages. They're intended to be to set you free to believe and follow the one true God and follow spiritually as well as physically. It's all a setup. It's all designed for the same picture. That's one thing that I happen to like about our Torah, is that it's not like Jesus comes along and changes anything. He doesn't change it. He just made it more obvious. And that the Torah's laws and rules were already designed to set men free from all their ailments, whether it's addictions or whether it's slavery to anything, right? It is to be free. The goal is to be free. The target is to be free. Get free in any means you have the ability to get free. And that's really the objective. Once you're free to make choices, good choices, choices that spiritually do not bind you as a slave would be bound by a physical body. It's a beautiful picture, and that our Torah is not oblivious to that concept. And we as people have to realize, wait a minute, God's far deeper than what we see. He's a spiritually active being in our lives before Jesus was around, and of course, obviously after. So this is a continuous idea to be taught, understood, and reiterated to our children. We have this Passover thing, tell our kids about slavery and being free, and God said it's free. It's not just about being physically free, but being spiritually free too. These are really important things, spiritually free from your vices, from your flesh, from your whatevers, to always strive for that freedom. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful part of religious belief in God.
Hey, when you mentioned about the Passover and about that story, you know, it always reminds me about Yeshua being our Passover lamb and the better covenant that he instituted with his blood and him being that great high priest, and how now the blood is on the doorposts of our heart, that now, you know, basically because of that better covenant that he made, that we can enter in boldly. And that's a beautiful picture from the children coming out of captivity and then the spiritual captivity that we're all born into, and how Yeshua has made that better covenant so we can be free.
Right.
Yeah, it's a beautiful picture. Beautiful picture. Thank you, brother.
Thank you. Any comments or questions?
Yeah.
Question Jeff otherwise.
Go ahead. Jeremiah 34, somebody, you know, pointed this out to me a while back about, does God change his mind? Because he, you know, in the beginning of that chapter, he said, Zedekiah will die peacefully, and then incense will be burned, as he, you know, he was burned to his ancestor, his forefather. And then down the line, God said, no, you're not going to die peacefully. You know, you're going to go to exile. And we know what happened to Zedekiah. His eyes were, you know, plucked out. And, you know, and I really didn't have a good answer for that. You know, to be like, okay, what happened to God in that? Does it just change his mind? But part of what I saw in that was the chapter that followed, you know, chapter 35, that God used an example of Rechabeth, you know, send the prophet to go talk to the sons of Rechabeth about the obedience that he wanted to show to the children of Israel and to all of us. And when the prophet went there, they told him, he said, the bowls of wine before them, said, drink. They said, no, we cannot drink because our forefather told us we should not drink wine, we should not plant vineyard, we should not build a house, so that we don't get distracted from doing the work of God. I believe that was my, you know, my interpretation of that. And God used that to tell the prophet and Zedekiah that if these people can obey their earthly father, and for me as your creator, I've told you over and over and over again, just like, you know, the Shabbat and some other things that God said before us. And we said, okay, you know, Christianity came now. That is not, you know, enforced anymore. But God still has a way to tell us that I don't change. Whatever is being said, it's said. Is it that you obey and then you reap the blessing, or you disobey, then you reap the consequences? Just like, you know, we've seen in this Zedekiah. So for me, it's kind of like, you know, I wish I'd read the chapter 35 to kind of say, okay, this is what God was trying to point out when I was having that, you know, the debate. So, but, you know, I just wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's fascinating that it's not that God changes per se, it's that we have influence on how that outcome turns out to be. We can affect it. What Rechabites did is that, hey, they changed what their outcome would have been. Had they not done that for however generations it was, well, they'd be all living inside cities and planting vineyards. They'd be sucked up with all the other misery and the consequences. So we as people, look at King Hezekiah, right? Which God said, okay, you're going to die. Then he prays, and goes, oh, we'll give you 13 more years, right? It's not that God changed mind per se, is that we ourselves, we have influence over God in that capacity. So, okay, God, you said this is what it is, but if I do these other things are also good, will that help? And he's like, yes, it does help. It's like a dad. What dad would not look at his child and say, hey, child, you've done this thing wrong. Okay, here's your consequence. Which says, okay, I understand the consequence. However, if I can do this and this and this, and give you a list of things how I can make up for part of these, the wrong I did, what father would say, forget all that stuff. I punish you anyway, forget it all. We'd say, wait a minute, what's your idea? Okay, try it, do it. And we'll make the consequence less severe if you're able to actually rectify the damage you've done or whatever you're done. Every parent would do that. That's just our nature. We want our child to realize, hey, let's improve my behavior. Let's fix the problem and make it better. That's one of the things I like about the Apostle Paul's argument about the Gentiles. Hey, these guys aren't perfect Jews. They aren't great to go in your synagogues, but they're trying. Encourage the improvement. Don't worry about the fact they're not there yet. That is our God does similarly. Jesus' point, go and sin no more, that girl, that woman, right? He doesn't say you weren't sinning before or that you should die for them all. Just stop doing it. Improve the behavior. So clearly God has what we call mercy. He has a bit to mercy people. Hey, there is behavior that we have huge influence on. It's our own behavior. And that can affect how God carries out what he says. Yeah, that's it's encouraging to me at least. that no matter what the consequence God dictates, we still have influence of how that plays out, whether it can be delayed by a generation or two in some instances, or soften it where it's not quite so severe as it could have been. Those are all merciful things our God does and has done for us. It's a beautiful thing to watch. Any comments, questions? Otherwise, I'm way over time. So I apologize.
No, I just, there's, when we were talking about being able to intercede and then God turning from a decision, one that really was profound that stuck out to me, that still sticks with me, is when Aaron and the calf and the worship, and then Moses going up and the Lord was wroth. He said, I am going to absolutely obliterate all of them. And I'll start over with you, Moses. And then Moses was like, oh Lord. He was like, our enemies, they're going to say that you just dragged us out here to kill us, and you're merciful, O Lord. You know, and then it says the Lord turned. The Lord turned. And I just was like, wow. That was just absolutely, utterly amazing that we can turn his heart. You know, that I just, wow. Because he's absolutely righteous in every decision that he makes, but he desires mercy. And I just was like, wow. Like when Moses pleaded for mercy, that it tugged on his heartstrings. And he saw, I mean, well, it's like he saw like maybe who he was in Moses. You know, that relationship. I mean, I wonder about that because he says we're supposed to be in his likeness. And when we bring to remembrance those things that, of God, like his heart, and, you know, those things. And I just think it's amazing. I just was like, it's the only thing that I could wrap my mind around, even though I see through a glass dimly. And I was like, wow, that's beautiful, Lord. Yeah.
But there's a discussion I had with my son, my oldest son, exactly about that exact topic early this week, pointing out this, hey, trying to teach him, show him examples, hey, our God is far more flexible than we imagine him to be. Look at the characters in our Bible that actually discuss and argue, not argues and fighting, but argues and say, hey, God, but what about this? In our Bible, it talks about them, and he listens and he responds. He's far more responsive. And it's not a criticism on other faith belief systems, but I point out to Isaac, my oldest son, Judaism looks at God that particular way. He's not a fixed being that cannot be approached or talked to or reasoned with. We are also created as an image. We're able to argue and think too. Not argue shouting, but argue as in discuss a matter. Hey, I have an idea. Hey, but what about this? And discuss it and talk to him as you would a dad or a friend. That's what he's designed for. That's what you would want for any relationship you have with someone else, to talk to me as a real person, not some overbearing or unapproachable being that cannot be conversed with. That wasn't the approach God wanted. That wasn't what he described. It's not the example he gave us. He gave us the example of actually talking to him. Abraham argued with God about, not argue as fighting, but argue as discussing, well, what about the Sodomites? And what about these details? And got him down to a certain level. And God said, okay, that's close enough. That's the idea, that we're encouraged in our Torah to actually have a real relationship conversation with our Creator, to talk to about these things. We're made in his image for a reason, including, you know, we can't think nearly as even close what he does, but we're creating the same conceptual idea that, hey, there's a bad things happened. I understand that there's a correct punishment, but let's discuss this and see what other options we have. And I liken to God, this example I give, and God's like, okay, here's my rules. Here's what's going to happen. And you come up to me and say, whatever, 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 let's discuss this. And I say, okay, what's your idea? God, pretend I'm God. I'm listening. Let's try it. See what happens. See what turns out. See if it improves. Go talk to them. Go preach. Go on, Noah. Go talk to people and see if they change. Try it. It may not work, but try it. And God's, to me, I think he's far more open to discussion of, hey, I know what the rules are, I know what the law is and what you said, but let's have a conversation about this and see if we have a better idea or an alternate choice you're willing to allow me to try. Makes us more like a God in that way too. It gives mercy far more power and God far more approachable concept of him, the ability to talk to him like you would a person, so to speak, almost like a friend.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.